Welcome to the Bregman Leadership Podcast. I'm Peter Bregman, CEO of Bregman Partners. We help companies achieve ambitious goals by strengthening leadership throughout the organization. I created this podcast to share ideas that you can use to become a more powerful and courageous leader. I have two people here with me today. One, a very dear friend who I've known for many, many years, whose name is Howard Jacobson. He has his own podcast, Plant Yourself Podcast. He has written a number of different books on health and diet, and he's also a marketer extraordinaire. And one thing I want to say about Howie is he's the one who got me into podcasting. It was through him that I, began to see this as a medium. Also, he is a PhD in stress management, which is going to be important for our conversation today around stress. We also have together with us Glenn Murphy. Glenn has been doing a lot of work on stress management and anxiety. He started out as a science writer. He worked with the journal Nature. He's written 26 books for kids focused on getting them into science. He's also a martial artist and works a lot with resiliency and stress. And I think together the conversation will be super interesting today. Glenn, Howie, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Thanks for having us.
So let's start with what is stress? Because I know that I feel it, and I know that I feel anxiety, and I wonder, let's get a definition first for what is stress. What is it that I experience?
Well, from the kind of medical point of view, stress is kind of a kind of behavior-altering pattern that has a physiological response on your body, which makes it difficult for you to deal with daily life processes and work. So it's a fairly kind of generic definition, which covers a lot of different things. And we tend to define it by its effects, basically what it does to us. And mostly we hear about stress when we think about stress-related illness. So that covers everything from kind of gastrointestinal disorders and sleep disorders all the way through to the acceleration or exacerbation of things like Alzheimer's and cancer and hypertension, obviously heart attacks. And people obviously go to the doctors and sort of say, oh, I have this problem. And it's a common refrain from doctors to say, well, you know, that's stress-related. You need to have less stress. But the problem is that this kind of view of stress is like an environmental pollutant, almost like kind of an air pollutant or a chemical pollutant, and something that you can retreat from doesn't really acknowledge your body's own part in that, right? And you don't really have control over how much stress is going on in the world or the things that might stress you, but you do have at least some control over your stress response. And so in a sense, stress is defined by things that are done to you, but it's also defined in that interaction between you and the stress trigger. So it's kind of a tricky thing to kind of define in one big go. Howie might have a different take on that, but
well, I've always thought of it as an exquisite adaptation that our body goes through to protect us from certain things in certain situations. And those certain things in certain situations used to be more prevalent than they are now, sort of life-threatening, caveman type of encounters. And in our modern life, the stress response that served us well as a survival mechanism no longer does so. It provides no benefit and very often creates chronic conditions over time just because we're calling upon it. It's like having a military that you call upon every time there's a fire in a trash can. That it gets fatigued, it stomps over the citizens, and it's an uncalled for, disproportionate response.
So when I look at my to-do list, and there's 100 items on my to-do list, and I begin to open up my email, and I suddenly see all these emails flooding in, and I realize, oh my God, I forgot that meeting, or I forgot to respond to these emails, or I have more to do than I have time for in my day, and I begin to feel stressed, the stress that I'm feeling might not be dissimilar, might not be dissimilar from the stress that one of my ancestors felt when they were looking at a saber-toothed tiger. And yet, my life isn't being threatened by my to-do list, but my response is the same. Am I understanding this correctly?
Yeah, it's pretty much, it's just as Howie described, yeah, these responses evolve to genuine threats to our actual existence. So a saber-toothed tiger bearing down on you, somebody from a rival tribe chasing you with something pointy, starvation, thirst, kind of all kinds of things, you know, snakes, spiders, all kinds of things which might prove life-ending to you. But what we've done in the absence of those things, at least in the West and the developed world for the most part, is that our brains are searching for those stimuli all of the time. And we're treating things which are basically threats to our ego or threats to our perception of our safety or our stability. And our bodies are responding to them as if they are existential threats. And they're really not. They're just kind of stresses of our own making a lot of the time. And that's easy to say, and you can kind of say it in a throwaway sense, but they become as real to people as the saber-toothed tiger if you kind of stay in those same brain patterns for long enough.
Well, and now we've added one more stress. So it's the stress of my reacting to my environment in a way that is going to lead to, God forbid, heart attacks and stress-related gastrointestinal diseases and things like that. So, and yet, when I look at my to-do list, I could take a deep breath and I could say, you know what? It's just a to-do list. It's not a saber-toothed tiger. It's not a rival tribe with a pointy stick. And I can just relax a little bit, except that I can't. What do I do?
Yeah, so herein kind of lies the problem a lot of the time. If you think of stress as purely kind of like a perception problem, like you have a stressor like a to-do list, and you're like, oh, don't be silly, Peter, it's only a to-do list. It's all good. It's not going to kill you. You'll be fine. If it were that simple, then your higher brain could override that response at any given time, and none of us would ever suffer from stress responses, or for that matter, we'd never be afraid of anything. We'd never feel anxiety. If we could override our emotions that easily, then it would be very, very simple. But unfortunately, we can't, because they kind of work from different mechanisms. Stress, or the stress response, is usually kind of mediated or fired up by the limbic system, the kind of fear sensing and anxiety sensing parts of the brain. And they kind of kick into gear in a way that makes them hard to override with just cognitive thought. The parts of our brain which direct reason and logic and kind of weighing things up are much, much, much newer than the older limbic kind of bits that are closer to the brainstem, which control kind of fear and anxiety and kind of ramping up a response to something we see as a threat. So kind of the shorthand for it is that we tend to think of our brains and bodies like a computer, which is controlling a robot. But it's actually much more like a rider sitting on top of a large, angry elephant. And the elephant has its own fears, it has its own emotions, it will react to things in certain ways. And the best that we can hope to do is acknowledge that the elephant is there, that it has its own responses, and then try and tame it a little bit. It's very, very difficult to get complete control, but we can at least steer. And the degree of training which you have enables you to steer. If you think you can just kind of slap the elephant to submission and get it to do what you want to do, sometimes you're in for a bit of a rude awakening when your stress levels stay high, even when you're reasoning with it to be like, this is silly. It's like sitting on an airplane if you're terrified of airplanes. You can tell yourself a million times that it's very, very rare to have plane crashes and everything's fine, but there's something in your limbic system saying, this is a flying death coffin, and it will just keep doing that the entire time you're on the airplane. So,
you know, it's interesting that you talk about training in that way, because the truth is we have been trained for years and years and years to use our minds to control our actions, right? We use willpower, so in fact, we've been training ourselves to talk rationally to ourselves, to convince ourselves and other people of things, you know, from an intellectual perspective. And we have undertrained our emotional responses. We've sort of undertrained in the ability to kind of manage ourselves emotionally. And I don't know if this is exactly the same thing you're talking about, but I wonder then, so what is the training that we should be doing, and how do we, you know, help me figure out how to respond to that moment with my to-do list, or that moment with the emails coming in and responses I have to give and not enough time to do it. And that's just one example. I mean, another one would be my boss yells at me, or another one might be that I'm worried about losing a project or losing a relationship. Like there's a million things that might end up creating stress, and there might be different ways to approach each of them. But what's the training then? How should I be training myself?
Well, the first thing to realize is how stress actually happens. It's more of a cycle, and it's kind of a self-reinforcing cycle than it is a simple kind of stimulus response thing. We tend to have this idea that stress is caused by one of these millions of triggers, and it could be any one of a million things, like you say. And then we get stressed out by it, by the boss shouting at us, by the snarky email, whatever it's going to be. And then there's an immediate response. Some things happen, and then adrenaline is released, and then you're kind of stressed or anxiety, you have anxiety attack, and it kind of goes out of control. Now, in reality, there are a whole much there are a whole bunch of other kind of steps that go in between those things. That and you might not even get full on hormone release. It might just be a nervous system response. So yes, there are stress triggers. There are things which you might consider as things that trigger your stress reaction. But usually, the first two things that happen are one, your breathing becomes disrupted, and that might mean that you hold your breath altogether. If somebody shouts at you, you might literally go and forget to breathe out. That sometimes happens, right? Or you might just go shallow. Your breathing gets very, very shallow and quiet, and you only kind of breathe kind of towards the collarbones and back, and you never take a deep diaphragmatic breath. Or it might just become erratic. So the depth and duration of the inhale might differ from the depth and duration of the exhale. And both of those things have different effects on your physiology. And then the second thing is that you manifest stress in a way which kind of is a throwback to real stressors. Like if a tiger suddenly jumps out from behind something, or you hear a large bang or a thunderclap, you don't say, oh my goodness, what was that? And keep exactly the same posture and frame of mind. You tend to kind of flinch. You'll kind of pull your ears in towards your shoulders, and your shoulders will kind of turtle up to protect your neck, and your spine will flex and bend. And that kind of very quick response, that flinch response, is what kind of happens to us with these psychological stresses, and it happens over a longer, more insidious period of time. So you get an email and you start to flinch a little bit, a little bit, a little bit, and before you know it, your posture's kind of out of whack and you're sitting there on a computer with your spine all bent up and your shoulders all turtled up. And your body reads that increase in tension, the increase in tension especially in the shoulders and the neck and in the core muscles further down the body, and the interruption in breathing as a sign that something stressful is going on. That feeds back into the brain centers that create initially interpreted a response. And then it becomes a self kind of perpetuating cycle where vague worry grows into anxiety and then eventually becomes full on panic. So the key to the training for this is to understand that it's a cycle and then find ways of interrupting the cycle. We can't interrupt a hormone release, not unless you kind of take a specific blocker, some kind of anti-anxiety medication or something like that. And that has been obviously one path towards treating long-term anxiety or recurrent anxiety. But that has side effects and you can become attenuated to it. All kinds of other things happen. So really the hormonal problem is not it. It's not about fighting the adrenaline. It's about kind of recognizing those early onset indicators of a stress response building up, the interruption of the breathing, the tension response within your body, the misshapen structure of your body as you experience these stimuli. And then you interrupt those back and you basically short circuit the response so that you don't get into full on stress panic mode. So I think in your book, Peter, I read again recently, and you talk about just the value of taking a couple of seconds and taking a deep breath and how that can really kind of be enough to turn things around. Sometimes it really can. Sometimes all you have to do is notice that you're holding your breath or you're in a weird breath pattern, and you take a deep breath and that can fix the problem. If it's a mild stressor, if it's a more severe one, or you're working on a deadline to a project and you're stressing yourself out over a longer period of time, you might need different tactics and techniques. And that's kind of our wider body of training comes in.
It's interesting. So, you know, on the one hand, we were sort of saying that you're, you know, intellectually, we can't respond to this. Mentally, rationally, we can't convince ourselves, even though that's what our training's been. And I was talking about emotions, but you're bringing it to physicality. You're basically saying, don't try to change your emotional reaction with a different kind of emotional reaction. Actually, just notice what's happening physically in your body and take some deep breaths and relax your body.
Yeah, it is. And it's about recognizing that, as I said, it's not a computer and a robot. Your brain does, of course, control the body and will control the body in a lot of different ways. But the body also has a feedback mechanism wherein it controls your brain. It controls your emotional state and your mental state, even the things that you think, the things that you desire, the habits that you have, all kinds of stuff. And the more and more we discover about neuroscience, especially within the last 20 years or so with functional magnetic resonance imaging and all of those kinds of things, they can study people under stress and experiencing fear and having weird habits and craving sweets and all kinds of stuff like that. And the more we realize that this kind of feedback from the body to the brain is almost as powerful as the brain to body connection. And actually, a lot of it is mediated by neurotransmitters and neural cells, which are in the stomach, that are in the gut. And we have almost as much of a volume of those neurotransmitters in our nerves around our stomach and our intestines as we do in the brain. So when somebody sort of says they have butterflies in their stomach or they feel it in their gut or there's an emotion, it's very, very real. It's like you have a second brain in your gut. And a lot of kind of work has been done about this, and even in kind of popular science culture and management training and things, people talk about that. Oh, the gut thing is real. But we're really just discovering year upon year how much control your body has over the highest functions of your brain. So it's not really worth thinking about the body and brain as, well, your brain does this and your body does this. It's almost as if the brain is divided into two parts, and the deeper, more core part, the older part, might as well be considered part of your body. And if you consider it that way, then it's like, well, there's two parts of your brain which they're kind of battling, and you can be like, well, I can override my emotions with my logic, or vice versa. But really what's happening is that your body's mediating that response. And if you ignore your body, if you ignore the state that your body's in, then you're fighting a losing battle. You won't be able to change your mental state if it's sufficiently stressed out and panicked.
I've got a couple of different questions come to me. One, I just want to ask you briefly, Howie, I wonder what, because you've done so much work on diet and the way we eat and the impact that that has on our health and our body. And I'm wondering, from a diet perspective, are there things that people can be doing that might be longer term? It might not be, well, I'm stressed. Here's my diet, right? Which is, I'm stressed, so I'm going to go eat a pint of ice cream. And now, like, I've really handled my stress, which we know I haven't. But are there longer term tricks that we can have, or a longer term diet that could help inoculate us a little bit against stress? Or are the two very unrelated?
Actually, I think of diet as one of the main contributors to stress. So if we don't think about stress simply as somebody said something to me or I got scared, but anything that kind of bends us out of whack, anything that we're not equipped to handle, then, you know, a poor diet is a stressor, and it might be a major stressor. So if it's causing inflammation all the time, if it's leading to brain fog, if it's causing us to have sugar crashes, then I think that's it's contributory. So, you know, I've worked with both of you and studied with both of you. I consider myself a student of both of you, and I think my value in the conversation is partly to know where each of you has come from. And so I think of stress for myself now, in having done the physical work and being a martial arts student of Oakland's for several years now, like this electric tea kettle that I have in our kitchen. And if you fill it with water and you push it on, it'll take a minute, 2 minutes, 3 minutes, depending on how much water is in it, to get hot. But if someone else has just made a cup of tea and I didn't know about it, and then I flick it on, it starts whistling almost immediately. And so what I'm learning is that if I already have this really, really high level of stress, whether it's from food, whether it's from thoughts, whether it's from temperature, whether it's from emotions, discomforts, whatever it is, that's my goal, is to bring that back down below boiling to somewhere where the slightest little trigger isn't going to send me over the edge.
Beautiful. So in effect, you know, stress is created anytime we are discordant with our environment. And that might be we're physically discordant with our environment, we're physically uncomfortable, or we're eating things that you know, kind of don't sit well with us, in a sense, don't help us to be and feel healthy, and we have sugar crashes or things. Or we're discordant with our environment because something's happening that's contrary to our values, or that, you know, we don't want to have happen, or that's unsettling to us, like my to-do list or the boss yelling or whatever. And so it's actually really interesting to me to think of stress in this way, which is that we can inoculate ourselves. I don't know that that's the right word, but we could bolster ourselves from being overstressed by creating an environment, both by what we eat, by how we sleep, by, you know, how we move in the world, that reflects our values, in a sense, and doesn't leave us discordant with the environment around us. Am I thinking about this correctly?
Yeah, I think that's very much in line with what we do. But it's worth kind of noting on top of that as well that stress itself isn't in and of itself a terrible thing. And they talk about eustress in the literature a lot, which is kind of positive stress. And when you have people in the corporate world, for example, you know, hedge fund managers or something, they'll talk about how I'm a stress bunny and I thrive on stress, and that's when I do my best work and all that kind of stuff. And to a certain extent, sometimes that's true and sometimes it's not. Sometimes they think they are, but they're deep down inside, the body is destroying itself while they're doing their high quality work, you know, and all this kind of thing as well. So it's true that if you can create an environment around yourself, if you eat a very, very clean diet, as Howie advocates, and you try and avoid things that trigger you off too much, and you keep your body neurologically clean, and you keep the inflammation very, very low, you keep your kind of base state quite low, and then you can enjoy a life free of stress. But the only problem that comes with that equation is that life has a way of messing things up. As Mike Tyson always liked to say, everybody has a plan until you get punched in the face, right? You can kind of go in there thinking you're going to do this, you're going to do that. And then one kind of big sucker punch, and it might be like a bereavement in the family. It might be losing your job all at once. It might be something quite major, you know, or a shock. You know, you run into somebody when you're driving or something like that. And it's in those times, most of all, when we need kind of methods to understand exactly what the stress is, how it's coming about in our bodies, and then to find a way of differentiating stress as a motivator from stress as something which shuts us down or that starts to have a deleterious effect on our bodies as well. So it's important to realize that stress is not a four-letter word. Right? Stress is something that's always there in our environment, like oxygen, like anything else, right? And like any other element, anything in a high enough dose is toxic, and stress is the same. And it's our response that we need to focus on, and not the stress itself or the source of the stress. And diet is certainly a huge part of that, but mediating your response to stress should be the central focus. And yeah, absolutely. I think the way that Howie describes it is that diet is a huge contributor, and it is, and it's probably one of the largest ones. And it's one that you ignore it at your peril. When I run workshops, I say, well, we get to the end of this workshop, and I sort of say, well, you have all the tools now that you need to keep yourself stress-free almost indefinitely. But here are five ways that you can completely undermine everything I've just taught you. And one of them is to eat terrible food, you know, to eat high-carb food that peaks and troughs you all the time, or to eat loads of fatty food, which kind of gives you kind of different kinds of responses and raises blood pressure and drops blood pressure in different ways. So it's and sleep is another one as well.
So let's talk about sleep for just 1 minute. We're running out of time here, but the sleep question is challenging because I find myself, my own sleep, disturbed at times from stress. And then the more I realize my sleep is being disturbed, and I know how poorly that's going to end up, you know, how much more stress that's going to end up giving me because I'm not sleeping, and that stresses me out even more. And diet, I feel like I can control. Diet, I could just force myself to eat healthy stuff if that's what I need to do. But sleep, I can't force myself to sleep. And if I'm up at 2 a.m, and now I'm stressed because I know I have a meeting at 7 and I'm not going to get enough sleep, so then I'm up for 3 hours stressing about the fact that I'm stressing. Help me out here, Glenn.
Well, that's where you have to have methods for gaining kind of a conscious control over things which you view as autonomic, as completely automatic. You have conscious control over which cookie you pick up or whether you pick up a cookie at all. It's harder to see sometimes how you can get control of blood pressure, how you can get control of kind of tension in your body, or that monkey mind thing where your mind is racing around and your higher brain just won't let go and won't let you sleep. But there are very, very specific methods for, you can get individualized control of your blood pressure through directed breathing and tension, and there are specific exercises that allow you to do that. Mind Structure is actually so good at it that he can be declared medically dead on the right side of his body while his left side of his pulse is pulsing away quite happily. So that's kind of the degree of control that you can get. You don't need that to be able to bring your blood pressure down and lull yourself into a state of more sleepiness. And the other one is that if the higher brain is kind of going crazy, you can use directed breathing in order to redirect blood flow away from the brain, and directed kind of tension work and certain types of movement, so that your brain is just not getting the blood supply it needs to keep worrying about what's going on tomorrow and what's on your to-do list. And there are a few other things like a cold water dousing, in this area, tipping 10 gallons of freezing water over the top of your head, that will put you to sleep almost immediately afterwards. And my wife actually suffered from lots of sleeplessness and kind of problems with that after she had our boy, and after he was weaned from breastfeeding and stuff. She would wake up in the middle of the night as if he needed breastfeeding, and then would stress out about not being able to go back to sleep. And reluctantly, after a while, she started taking on this practice. And now if she wakes up in the night, she dumps 5 gallons of cold water over head and goes back to sleep within 5 minutes.
So I have an urge to make fun of you for this, but I'm not going to. But I actually may even try it. If I'm awake, I might just put my head under the bath tap and turn on cold water and see if it works.
But if it doesn't work, you have to do a whole 5 to 10 gallons.
I could keep the tap running for quite some time. But if I don't do that, like, you know, what breathing technique might you suggest that people could try if they have this kind of a problem? Like just a quick snippet.
Quickest breathing technique, lay flat on your back so you have no tension whatsoever in your body. You're just falling under gravity into the floor. And then breathe as softly as possible in through the nose, and then allow the breath to come out of your mouth like a sigh, as if it's just kind of rasping out of your body. Don't suck it in and blow it out. Just see if you can breathe as softly as possible, almost as if you're hiding from somebody that's sneaking around in your house and you're hiding under bed. Very, very softly. And as you start to do that, you'll feel your own tension a lot more. The pressurization of your body as you breathe in alert you to tension within your body, and you'll naturally start to relax things, especially around the breathing muscles in the chest and in the top of the neck and in the diaphragm. And then that will start to relax you on its own. And it probably takes about 5 minutes of that. You'll start to feel the pulse all around around the body, and then that redirects blood flow away from your head and into the rest of your body in a very directed way.
That's great. That's great. It's super practical, and I'm going to try that. Thank you, Glenn Murphy, Howie Jacobson. Glenn, tell us how to get in touch with you or find out more about the work that you're doing.
Yeah, you can visit our website at NC, that's North Carolina, Systema.com. So it's S-Y-S-T-E-M-A, system with an A on the end. That's the Russian method that we train. And we have information on there about our stress-proofing workshops, and in particular, the once-a-year stress-proofing retreat that we do in the Blue Ridge Mountains, which is a really lovely way to get all of your stress-proof training in one go. Just lie around a lake for 3 days. Pretty much it's very conducive to being stress-free anyway. So if you go to ncsystema.com /retreat, that'll give you all the information on that.
Thank you. And Howie, how could people get in touch with you or find out more about your work?
Well, they could go to plantyourself.com and check out currently 138 episodes of the podcast, including both of you gentlemen. If they're interested in health consulting, they can go to trianglebewell.com. That's my practice website.
Thank you both. And it's a great conversation. You know, stress is not a bad thing, as you said, but it's a challenge at times. And to actually have a response that we could bring to bear on it is really useful. And I know that shifting our emotions at a moment's notice often doesn't work, and arguing myself out of it never works. So, you know, this focus on the body, on the physicality of it, on what I'm eating in general and how I'm treating my body, and then breathing and relaxing, I just might try dumping 5 gallons of ice cold water on my head and see if that helps also. So Glenn and Howie, thank you so much for being on the show. It's a real pleasure having you.
Thanks.
Thank you very much.
If you enjoyed this episode of the Bregman Leadership Podcast, please subscribe and leave a review on iTunes. For more information about the Bregman Leadership Intensive, as well as access to my articles, videos, and podcasts, visit peterbregman.com. Thank you to Claire Marshall for producing this episode, and to Brian Wood, who created our music. Thanks for listening, and stay tuned for the next great conversation.